2 past midnight. Secret window, secret garden. From the book 4 past midnight by Stephen King. Read by James Woods. "You stole my story," the man on the doorstep said. "You stole my story, and something's got to be done about it. Right is right, fair is fair, and something has to be done." Morton Rainey, who had just gotten up from a nap and who was still feeling only halfway into the real world, didn't have the slightest idea what to say. This was never the case when he was at work, sick or well, wide awake or half asleep. He was a writer, and hardly ever at a loss when it became necessary to fill a character's mouth with a snappy comeback. Rainey opened his mouth, found no snappy comeback there, not even a limp one, in fact, and so closed it again. He thought, "This man doesn't look exactly real. He looks like a character out of a novel by William Faulkner." This was of no help in resolving the situation, but it was undeniably true. The man who had rung Rainey's doorbell out here in the western Maine version of nowhere looked about 45. He was very thin. His face was calm, almost serene, but carved with deep lines. They moved horizontally across his high brow in regular waves, cut vertically downward from the ends of his thin lips to his jawline, and radiated outward in tiny sprays from the corners of his eyes. The eyes were bright, unfaded blue. Rainey couldn't tell what color his hair was. He wore a large black hat with a round crown planted squarely on his head. The underside of the brim touched the tops of his ears. It looked like the sort of hat Quakers wore. He had no sideburns either, and for all Morton Rainey knew, he might be as bald as Telly Savalas under that round crowned felt hat. He was wearing a blue work shirt. It was buttoned neatly all the way to the loose, razor-reddened flesh of his neck, although he wore no tie. The bottom of the shirt disappeared into a pair of blue jeans that looked a little too big for the man who was wearing them. They ended in cuffs, which laid neatly on a pair of faded yellow work shoes, which looked made for walking in a furrow of played-out earth about 3.5 feet behind a mule's ass. "Well?" he asked when Rainey continued to say nothing. "I don't know you," Rainey said finally. It was the first thing he'd said since he'd gotten up off the couch and come to answer the door, and it sounded sublimely stupid in his own ears. "I know that," said the man. "That doesn't matter. I know you, Mr. Rainey. That's what matters." And then he reiterated, "You stole my story." He held out his hand, and for the first time Rainey saw that he had something in it. It was a sheaf of paper, but not just any old sheaf of paper. It was a manuscript. And after you've been in the business a while, he thought, you always recognize the look of a manuscript, especially an unsolicited one. And belatedly, he thought, good thing for you it wasn't a gun, Mort, old kid. You would have been in hell before you knew you were dead. And even more belatedly, he realized that he was probably dealing with one of the crazy folks. It was long overdue, of course. Although his last three books had been bestsellers, this was his first visit from one of that fabled tribe. He felt a mixture of fear and chagrin, and his thoughts narrowed to a single point: how to get rid of the guy as fast as possible and with as little unpleasantness as possible. I don't read manuscripts, he began.
You read this one already,
the man with the hard-working sharecropper's face said evenly.
You stole it.
He spoke as if stating a simple fact, like a man noting that the sun was out and it was a pleasant fall day. All of Mort's thoughts were belated this afternoon, it seemed. He now realized for the first time how alone he was out here. He had come to the house in Tashmore Glen in early October, after 2 miserable months in New York. His divorce had become final just last week. It was a big house, but it was a summer place. And Tashmore Glen was a summer town. There were maybe 20 cottages on this particular road running along the north bay of Tashmore Lake, and in July or August there would be people staying in most or all of them. But this wasn't July or August. It was late October. The sound of a gunshot, he realized, would probably drift away unheard. If it was heard, the hearers would simply assume someone was shooting at quail or pheasant. It was the season. I can assure you...
I know you can,
the man in the black hat said with that same unearthly patience.
I know that.
Behind him, Mort could see the car the man had come in. It was an old station wagon which looked as if it had seen a great many miles, very few of them, on good roads. He could see that the plate on it wasn't from the state of Maine, but couldn't tell what state it was from. He'd known for some time now that he needed to go to the optometrist and have his glasses changed, had even planned early last summer to do that little chore. But then Henry Young had called him one day in April, asking who the fellow was he'd seen Amy with at the mall. Some relative, maybe. And the suspicions which had culminated in the eerily quick and quiet no-fault divorce had begun, the shitstorm which had taken up all his time and energy these last few months. During that time, he had been doing well if he remembered to change his underwear, let alone handle more esoteric things like optometrist appointments. If you want to talk to someone about some grievance you feel you have, Mort began uncertainly, hating the pompous, talking boilerplate sound of his own voice, but not knowing how else to reply, you could talk to my agent.
This is between you and me, the man on the doorstep said patiently.
Bump, Mort's tomcat, had been curled up on the low cabinet built into the side of the house. You had to store your garbage in a closed compartment, or the raccoons came in the night and pulled it all over hell. And now he jumped down and twined his way sinuously between the stranger's legs. The stranger's bright blue eyes never left Rainey's face.
We don't need any outsiders, Mr. Rainey. It is strictly between you and me.
I don't like being accused of plagiarism, if that's what you're doing, Mort said. At the same time, part of his mind was cautioning him that you had to be very careful when dealing with people of the crazy folks tribe. Humor them, yes. But this man didn't seem to have a gun, and Mort outweighed him by at least 50 pounds. I've also got 5 or 10 years on him by the look, he thought. He had read that a bona fide crazy guy could muster abnormal strength, but he was damned if he was simply going to stand here and let this man he had never seen before go on saying that he, Morton Rainey, had stolen his story, not without some kind of rebuttal.
I don't blame you for not liking it, the man in the black hat said.
He spoke in the same patient and serene way. He spoke, Mort thought, like a therapist whose work is teaching small children who are retarded in some mild way.
But you did it. You stole my story.
You'll have to leave, Mort said. He was fully awake now, and he no longer felt so bewildered at such a disadvantage. I have nothing to say to you.
Yes, I'll go, the man said. We'll talk more later.
He held out the sheaf of manuscript, and Mort actually found himself reaching for it. He put his hand back down to his side just before his uninvited and unwanted guest could slip the manuscript into it, like a process server finally slipping a subpoena to a man who has been ducking it for months. I'm not taking that, Mort said. And part of him was marveling at what a really accommodating beast a man was. When someone held something out to you, your first instinct was to take it, no matter if it was a check for $1,000 or a stick of dynamite with a lit and fizzing fuse. Your first instinct was to take it.
Won't do you any good to play games with me, Mr. Rainey, the man said mildly. This has got to be settled.
So far as I'm concerned, it is, Mort said, and closed the door on that lined, used, and somehow timeless face. He'd only felt a moment or two of fear, and those had come when he first realized, in a disoriented and sleep-befogged way, what this man was saying. Then it had been swallowed by anger at being bothered during his nap, and more anger at the realization that he was being bothered by a representative of the crazy folks. Once the door was closed, the fear returned. He pressed his lips together and waited for the man to start pounding on it. And when that didn't come, he became convinced that the man was just standing out there, still as a stone and as patient as same, waiting for him to reopen the door, as he would have to do sooner or later. Then he heard a low thump, followed by a series of light steps crossing the board porch. Mort walked into the master bedroom, which looked out onto the driveway. There were two big windows in here, one giving on the driveway and the shoulder of hill behind it, the other providing a view of the slope which fell away to the blue and agreeable expanse of Tashmore Lake. Both windows were reflectorized, which meant he could look out, but anyone trying to look in would see only his own distorted image, unless he put his nose to the glass and cupped his eyes against the glare. He saw the man in the work shirt and cupped blue jeans walking back to his old station wagon. From this angle, he could make out the license plate's state of issue. Mississippi. As the man opened the driver's side door, Mort thought, "Oh, shit, the gun's in the car." He didn't have it on him because he believed he could reason with me, whatever his idea of reasoning is, but now he's going to get it and come back. It's probably in the glove compartment or under the seat. But the man got in behind the wheel, pausing only long enough to take off his black hat and toss it down beside him. As he slammed the door and started the engine, Mort thought, there's something different about him now. But it wasn't until his unwanted afternoon guest had backed up the driveway and out of sight behind the thick screen of bushes Mort kept forgetting to trim that he realized what it was. When the man got into his car, he had no longer been holding the manuscript. It was on the back porch. There was a rock on it to keep the individual pages from blowing all over the little dooryard in the light breeze. The small thump he heard had been the man putting the rock on the manuscript. Mort stood in the doorway, hands in the pockets of his khaki pants, looking at it. He knew that craziness wasn't catching, except maybe in cases of prolonged exposure, he supposed, but he still didn't want to touch the goddamn thing. He supposed he would have to, though. He didn't know just how long he would be here. A day, a week, a month, and a year all looked equally possible at this point, but he couldn't just let the fucking thing sit there. Greg Carstairs, his caretaker, would be down early this afternoon to give him an estimate on how much it would cost to reshingle the house, for one thing, and Greg would wonder what it was. Worse, he would probably assume it was Mort's, and that would entail more explanation than the damn thing was worth. He stood there until the sound of his visitor's engine had merged into the low, slow hum of the afternoon. And then he went out on the porch, walking carefully in his bare feet. The porch had needed painting for at least a year now, and the dry wood was prickly with potential splinters, and tossed the rock into the juniper-choked gully to the left of the porch. He picked up the little sheaf of pages and looked down at it. The top one was a title page. It read, "Secret Window, Secret Garden," by John Shooter. Mort felt a moment's relief in spite of himself. He had never heard of John Shooter, and he had never read or written a short story called Secret Window, Secret Garden in his life. He tossed the manuscript in the kitchen wastebasket on his way by, went back to the couch in the living room, lay down again, and was asleep in 5 minutes. He dreamed of Amy. He slept a great lot, and he dreamed of Amy a great lot these days. And waking up to the sound of his own hoarse shouts no longer surprised him much. He supposed it would pass. The next morning, he was sitting in front of his word processor in the small nook off the living room, which had always served as his study when they were down here. The word processor was on, but Mort was looking out the window at the lake. Two motorboats were out there, cutting broad white wakes in the blue water. He had thought they were fishermen at first, but they never slowed down, just cut back and forth across each other's bows in big loops. Kids, he decided, just kids playing games. They weren't doing anything very interesting, but then neither was he. He hadn't written anything worth a damn since he had left Amy. He sat in front of the word processor every day from 9 to 11, just as he had every day for the last 3 years. And for about 1,000 years before that, he had spent those 2 hours sitting in front of an old Royal office model. But for all the good he was doing with it, he might as well have traded it in on a motorboat and gone out grab-assing with the kids on the lake. Today, he had written the following lines of deathless prose during his 2-hour stint. 4 days after George had confirmed to his own satisfaction that his wife was cheating on him, he confronted her. "I have to talk to you, Abby," he said. It was no good. It was too close to real life to be good. It had never been so hot when it came to real life. Maybe that was part of the problem. He turned off the word processor, realizing just a second after he'd flicked the switch that he'd forgotten to save the document. Well, that was all right. Maybe it had even been the critic in his subconscious telling him the document wasn't worth saving. Mrs. Gavin had apparently finished upstairs. The drone of the Electrolux had finally ceased. She came in every Tuesday to clean, and she had been shocked into a silence very unlike her when Mort had told her 2 Tuesdays ago that he and Amy were quits. He suspected that she had liked Amy a good deal more than she had liked him. But she was still coming, and Mort supposed that was something. He got up and went out into the living room just as Mrs. Gavin came down the main staircase. She was holding the vacuum cleaner hose and dragging the small tubular machine after her. It came down in a series of thumps, looking like a small mechanical dog. "If I tried to pull a vacuum cleaner downstairs that way, I'd smack it into one of my ankles and then roll all the way to the bottom," Mort thought. "How does she get it to do that, I wonder?" "Hi there, Mrs. G," he said, and crossed the living room toward the kitchen door. He wanted a Coke. Writing shit always made him thirsty. "Hello, Mr. Rainey." He had tried to get her to call him Mort, but she wouldn't. She wouldn't even call him Morton. Mrs. Gavin was a woman of her principles, but her principles had never kept her from calling his wife Amy. "Maybe I should tell her I caught Amy in bed with another man at one of Derry's finer motels," Mort thought as he pushed through the swing door. "She might go back to calling her Mrs. Rainey again, at the very least." This was an ugly and mean-spirited thought, the kind of thinking he suspected was at the root of his writing problems. But he didn't seem to be able to help it. Perhaps it would also pass, like the dreams. For some reason, this idea made him think of a bumper sticker he'd seen once on the back of a very old VW Beetle. "Constipated. Cannot pass," the sticker had read. As the kitchen door swung back, Mrs. Gavin called, "I found one of your stories in the trash, Mr. Rainey. I thought you might want it, so I put it on the counter." "Okay," he said, having no idea what she might be talking about. He was not in the habit of tossing bad manuscripts or frags in the kitchen trash. When he produced a stinker, and lately he had produced more than his share, it went either directly to data heaven or into the circular file to the right of his word processing station. The man with the lined face and round black Quaker hat never even entered his mind. He opened the refrigerator door and moved 2 small Tupperware dishes filled with nameless leftovers, discovered a bottle of Pepsi, and opened it as he nudged the fridge door closed with his hip. As he went to toss the cap in the trash, he saw the manuscript. Its title page was spotted with something that looked like orange juice, but otherwise it was all right, sitting on the counter by the Silex. Then he remembered. John Shooter, right. Charter member of the Crazy Folks, Mississippi branch. He took a drink of Pepsi, then picked up the manuscript. He put the title page on the bottom and saw this at the head of the first page. John Shooter, General Delivery, Delacorte, Mississippi. 30 pages, approximately 7,500 words, selling first serial rights, North America. Secret Window, Secret Garden, by John Shooter. The manuscript had been typed on a good grade of bond paper, but the machine must have been a sad case. An old office model, from the look, and not very well maintained. Most of the letters were as crooked as an old man's teeth. He read the first sentence, then the second, then the third, and for a few moments, clear thought ceased. Todd Downey thought that a woman who would steal your love when your love was really all you had was not much of a woman. He therefore decided to kill her. He would do it in the deep corner formed where the house and the barn came together at an extreme angle. He would do it where his wife kept her garden. "Oh, shit," Mort said, and put the manuscript back down. His arm struck the Pepsi bottle. It overturned, foaming and fizzing across the counter and running down the cabinet facings. "Oh, shit!" he yelled. Mrs. Gavin came in a hurry, surveyed the situation, and said, "Oh, that's nothing. I thought from the sound that maybe you'd cut your own throat. Move a little now, can't you, Mr. Rainey?" He moved, and the first thing she did was to pick the sheaf of manuscript up off the counter and thrust it back into his hands. It was still okay. The soda had run the other way. He had once been a man with a fairly good sense of humor. He had always thought so anyway. But as he looked down at the little pile of paper in his hands, the best he could manage was a sour sense of irony. "It's like the cat in the nursery rhyme," he thought. "The one that kept coming back." "If you're trying to wreck that," Mrs. Gavin said, nodding at the manuscript as she got a dish rag from under the sink, "you're on the right track." "It's not mine," he said. But it was funny, wasn't it? Yesterday, when he had almost reached out and taken the script from the man who had brought it to him, he'd thought about what an accommodating beast a man was. Apparently that urge to accommodate stretched in all directions, because the first thing he'd felt when he read those three sentences was guilt. And wasn't that just what Shooter, if that was really his name, had wanted him to feel? Of course it was. "You stole my story," he'd said. And weren't thieves supposed to feel guilty? "Pardon me, Mr. Rainey," Mrs. Gavin said, holding up the dish rag. He stepped aside so she could get at the spill. It's not mine," he repeated, insisted really. "Oh," she said, wiping up the spill on the counter and then stepping to the sink to wring out the cloth. "I thought it was." "It says John Shooter," he said, putting the title page back on top and turning it toward her. "See?" Mrs. Gavin favored the title page with the shortest glance politeness would allow and then began wiping the cabinet faces. "Thought it was one of them, whatchamacallums," she said. "Pseudonames, or nims, whatever the word is for pen names." "I don't use one," he said. "I never have." This time she favored him with a brief glance, country shrewd and slightly amused, before getting down on her knees to wipe up the puddle of Pepsi on the floor. "Don't suppose you'd tell me if you did," she said. "I'm sorry about the spill," he said, edging toward the door. "My job," she said shortly. She didn't look up again. Mort took the hint and left. He stood in the living room for a moment, looking at the abandoned vacuum cleaner in the middle of the rug. In his head, he heard the man with the lined face saying patiently, "This is between you and me. We don't need any outsiders, Mr. Rainey. It is strictly between you and me." Mort thought of that face, recalled it carefully to a mind which was trained to recall faces and actions, and thought, it wasn't just a momentary aberration, or a bizarre way to meet an author he may or may not consider famous. He will be back. He suddenly headed back into his study, rolling the manuscript into a tube as he went. Three of the four study walls were lined with bookshelves, and one of them had been set aside for the various editions, domestic and foreign, of his works. He had published 6 books in all, 5 novels and a collection of short stories. The book of short stories and his first 2 novels had been well received by his immediate family and a few friends. His 3rd novel, The Organ Grinder's Boy, had been an instant bestseller. The early works had been reissued after he became a success and had done quite well, but they had never been as popular as his later books. The short story collection was called Everybody Drops the Dime, and most of the tales had originally been published in the men's magazines, sandwiched around pictures of women wearing lots of eye makeup and not much else. One of the stories, however, had been published in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. It was called Sewing Season. And it was to this story he now turned. A woman who would steal your love when your love was all you had wasn't much of a woman. That, at least, was Tommy Havelock's opinion. He decided to kill her. He even knew the place he would do it, the exact place. The little patch of garden she kept in the extreme angle formed where the house and the barn came together. Mort sat down and worked his way slowly through the 2 stories. Reading back and forth. By the time he was halfway through, he understood he really didn't need to go any further. They varied in diction in some places, and many others even that was the same, word for word. Diction aside, they were exactly the same. In both of them, a man killed his wife. In both of them, the wife was a cold, loveless bitch who cared only for her garden and her canning. In both of them, the killer buried his spousal victim in her garden and then tended it, growing a really spectacular crop. In Morton Rainey's version, the crop was beans. In Shooter's, it was corn. In both versions, the killer eventually went crazy and was discovered by the police eating vast amounts of the vegetable in question and swearing he would be rid of her, that in the end he would finally be rid of her. Mort had never considered himself much of a horror story writer, and there was nothing supernatural about sowing season. But it had been a creepy little piece of work all the same. Amy had finished it with a little shiver and said, "I suppose it's good, but that man's mind, God, Mort, what a can of worms." That had summed up his own feelings pretty well. The landscape of sowing season wasn't one he would care to travel through often. And it was no telltale heart. But he had thought he had done a fair job of painting Tom Havelock's homicidal breakdown. The editor at EQMM had agreed, and so had the readers. The story had generated favorable mail. The editor had asked for more, but Mort had never come up with another story even remotely like Sowing Season. "I know I can do it," Todd Downey said, helping himself to another ear of corn from the steaming bowl. "I am sure that in time, all of her will be gone." That was how Shooter's ended. "I am confident I can take care of this business," Tom Havelock told him, and helped himself to another portion of beans from the brimming, steaming bowl. "I am sure that in time, her death will be a mystery even to me." That was how Mort Rainey's ended. Mort closed his copy of Everybody Drops the Dime and replaced it thoughtfully on a shelf of first editions. He sat down and began to rummage slowly and thoroughly through the drawers of his desk. It was a big one, so big the furniture men had had to bring it into the room in sections, and it had a lot of drawers. The desk was solely his domain. Neither Amy nor Mrs. G had ever set a hand to it, and the drawers were full of 10 years' worth of accumulated rickrack. It had been 4 years since Mort had given up smoking. If there were any cigarettes left in the house, this was where they would be. If he found some, he would smoke. Just about now, he was crazy for a smoke. If he didn't find any, that was all right, too. Going through his junk was soothing. Old letters which he'd put aside to answer and never had, what had once seemed so important now looking antique, even arcane. Postcards he'd bought but never mailed. Chunks of manuscript in varying stages of completion, half a bag of very elderly Doritos. Envelopes, paperclips, canceled checks. He could sense layers here which were almost geological, layers of summer life frozen in place, and it was soothing. He finished one drawer and went on to the next, thinking all the while about John Shooter, and how John Shooter's story, his story, God damn it, had made him feel. The most obvious thing, of course, was that it had made him feel like he needed a cigarette. This wasn't the first time he'd felt that way in the last 4 years. There had been times when just seeing someone puffing away behind the wheel of a car next to his at a stoplight could set off a raging momentary lust for tobacco. But the key word there, of course, was momentary. Those feelings passed in a hurry, like fierce rain squalls. 5 minutes after a blinding silver curtain of rain has dropped out of the sky, the sun is shining again. He'd never felt the need to turn into the next convenience store on his way for a deck of smokes. Or go rummaging through his glove compartment for a stray or two as he was now rummaging through his desk. He felt guilty, and that was absurd, infuriating. He had not stolen John Shooter's story, and he knew he hadn't. If there had been stealing, and there must have been, for the two stories to be that close without prior knowledge on the part of one of the two players was impossible for Mort to believe, then it had been Shooter who had stolen from him. Of course. It was as plain as the nose on his face. Or the round black hat on John Shooter's head. Yet he still felt upset, unsettled, guilty. He felt at a loss in a way for which there was perhaps no word. And why? Well, because... At that moment, Mort lifted up a Xerox of the organ grinder's boy manuscript, and there beneath it was a package of L&M cigarettes. Did they even make L&Ms anymore? He didn't know. The pack was old, crumpled, but definitely not flat. He took it out and looked at it. He reflected that he must have bought this particular pack in 1985, according to the informal science of stratification one might call, for want of a better word, deskology. He peered inside the pack. He saw three little coffin nails, all in a row. Time travelers from another age, Mort thought. He stuck one of the cigarettes in his mouth and went out to the kitchen to get a match from the box by the stove. Time travelers from another age, riding up through the years, patient cylindrical voyagers, their mission to wait, to persevere, to bide until the proper moment to start me on the road to lung cancer again finally arrives. And it seems like the time has finally come. "It'll probably taste like shit," he said aloud to the empty house. Mrs. Gavin had long since gone home, and set fire to the tip of the cigarette. It didn't taste like shit, though. It tasted pretty good. He wandered back toward his study, puffing away and feeling pleasantly lightheaded. Ah, the dreadful patient persistence of addiction, he thought. What had Hemingway said? "Not this August, nor this September. This year you have to do what you like. But the time comes around again. It always does. Sooner or later you stick something back in your big, dumb old mouth again. A drink. A smoke. Maybe the barrel of a shotgun. Not this August, nor this September." Unfortunately, this was October. At an earlier point in his prospecting, he had found an old bottle half full of Planters peanuts. He doubted if the nuts would be fit to eat, but the lid of the bottle made a fine ashtray. He sat behind his desk, looked out at the lake. Like Mrs. G., the boats which had been out there earlier were gone. Relished his old vile habit and found he could think about John Shooter and John Shooter's story with a little more equanimity. The man was one of the crazy folks, of course. That was now proven in brass, if any further proof had been needed. As to how it had made him feel, finding that the similarity actually existed, well, a story was a thing, a real thing. You could think of it like that anyway, especially if someone had paid you for it, but in another more important way, it wasn't a thing at all. It wasn't like a vase or a chair or an automobile. It was ink on paper. But it wasn't the ink and it wasn't the paper. People sometimes asked him where he got his ideas, and although he scoffed at the question, it always made him feel vaguely ashamed, vaguely spurious. They seemed to feel there was a central idea dump somewhere, just as there was supposed to be an elephant graveyard somewhere and a fabled lost city of gold somewhere else. And he must have a secret map which allowed him to get there and back, but Mort knew better. He could remember where he had been when certain ideas came to him, and he knew that the idea was often the result of seeing or sensing some odd connection between objects or events or people which had never seemed to have the slightest connection before. But that was the best he could do. As to why he should see these connections or want to make stories out of them after he had, well, to that he hadn't a clue. If John Shooter had come to his door and said, "You stole my car," instead of, "You stole my story," Mort would have scotched the idea quickly and decisively. He would have done it even if the two cars in question had been the same year, make, model, and color. He would have shown the man in the round black hat his automobile registration, invited him to compare the number on the pink slip to the one on the doorpost, and sent him packing. But when you got a story idea, no one gave you a bill of sale. There was no provenance to be traced. Why would there be? Nobody gave you a bill of sale when you got something for free. You charged whoever wanted to buy that thing from you. Oh, yes, all the traffic would bear and a little more than that if you could, to make up for all the times the bastards shorted you, magazines, newspapers, book publishers, movie companies. But the item came to you free, clear, and unencumbered. That was it, he decided. That was why he felt guilty even when he knew he hadn't plagiarized Farmer John Shooter's story. He felt guilty because writing stories had always felt a little bit like stealing, and probably always would. John Shooter just happened to be the first person to show up on his doorstep and accuse him of it right out loud. He thought that, subconsciously, he had been expecting something like this for years. Mort crushed out his cigarette and decided to take a nap. Then he decided that was a bad idea. It would be better, healthier both mentally and physically, to eat some lunch, read for half an hour or so, and then go for a nice long walk down by the lake. He was sleeping too much, and sleeping too much was a sign of depression. Halfway to the kitchen, he deviated to the long sectional couch by the window wall in the living room. The hell with it, he thought, putting a pillow under his neck and another one behind his head. I am depressed. His last thought before drifting off was a repeat. He's not done with me yet. Oh no, not this guy. He's a repeater. He dreamed he was lost in a vast cornfield. He blundered from one row to the next, and the sun glinted off the watches he was wearing, half a dozen on each forearm, and each watch set to a different time. Please, help me, he cried. Someone, please, help me. I am lost and afraid. Ahead of him, the corn on both sides of the row shook and rustled. Amy stepped out from one side. John Shooter stepped out from the other. Both of them held knives. I am confident I can take care of the bins, Shooter said as they advanced on him with their knives raised. I'm sure that in time, your death will be a mystery, even to us. Mort turned to run, but a hand, Amy's he was sure, seized him by the belt and pulled him back, and then the knives glittering in the hot sun of this huge secret garden. It was the telephone which woke him an hour and a quarter later. He struggled out of a terrible dream. Someone had been chasing him. That was all he could clearly remember. To a sitting position on the couch. He was horribly hot. Every inch of his skin seemed to be running with sweat. The sun had crept around to the side of the house while he was sleeping and had shone in on him through the window wall for God knew how long. Mort walked slowly toward the telephone table in the front hall, plodding like a man in a diver's suit walking in the bed of a river against the current, his head thumping slowly, his mouth tasting like old dead gopher shit. For every step he took forward, the entrance to the hall seemed to retreat a step. And it occurred to Mort, not for the first time, that hell was probably like the way you felt after sleeping too long and too hard on a hot afternoon. The worst of it wasn't physical. The worst was that dismaying, disorienting sense of being outside yourself somehow. Just an observer looking through dual TV cameras with blurry lenses. He picked up the phone, thinking it would be Shooter. Yeah, it'll be him all right. The one person in the whole wide world I shouldn't be talking to with my guard down and one half of my mind feeling unbuttoned from the other half. Sure, it'll be him. Who else? Hello? It wasn't Shooter. But as he listened to the voice on the other end of the line reply to his greeting, he discovered there was at least one other person to whom he had no business talking while in a psychically vulnerable state. Hello, Mort? Amy said. Are you all right? Sometime later that afternoon, Mort donned the extra-large red flannel shirt he used as a jacket in the early fall and took the walk he should have taken earlier. Bump the cat followed him long enough to ascertain that Mort was serious, then returned to the house. He walked slowly and deliberately through an exquisite afternoon, which seemed to be all blue sky, red leaves, and golden air. He walked with his hands stuffed into his pockets, trying to let the lake's quiet work through his skin and calm him down, as it had always done before. He supposed that was the reason he had come here instead of staying in New York, as Amy had expected him to, while they trundled steadily along toward divorce. He had come here because it was a magic place, especially in autumn. And he had felt, when he arrived, that if there was a sad sack anywhere on the planet who needed a little magic, he was that person. And if that old magic failed him now that the writing had turned so sour, he wasn't sure what he would do. It turned out that he didn't need to worry about it. After a while, the silence and that queer atmosphere of suspension which always seemed to possess Tashmore Lake when fall had finally come, and the summer people had finally gone, began to work on him. Loosening him up like gently kneading hands. But now he had something besides John Shooter to think about. He had Amy to think about as well. Of course I'm all right, he'd said, speaking as carefully as a drunk trying to convince people that he's sober. In truth, he was still so muzzy that he felt a little bit drunk. The shapes of words felt too big in his mouth, like chunks of soft, friable rock, and he had proceeded with great care, groping his way through the opening formalities and gambits of telephone conversation as if for the first time. How are you? Oh, fine, I'm fine, she said, and then trilled the quick little laugh, which usually meant she was either flirting or nervous as hell. And Mort doubted that she was flirting with him, not at this point. The realization that she was nervous, too, set him a little more at ease. You know, it's just that you're alone down there, and almost anything could happen, and nobody would know. She broke off abruptly. I'm really not alone, he said mildly. Mrs. Gavin was here today, and Greg Carstairs is always around. Oh, I forgot about the roof repairs, Amy said, and for a moment he marveled at how natural they sounded. How natural and undivorced. Listening to us, Mort thought, you'd never guess there's a rogue real estate agent in my bed, or what used to be my bed. He waited for the anger to come back, the hurt, jealous, cheated anger. But only a ghost stirred where those lively, if unpleasant, feelings had been. Well, Greg didn't forget, he assured her. He came down yesterday and crawled around on the roof for an hour and a half. How bad is it? He told her, and they talked about the roof for the next 5 minutes or so, while Mort slowly woke up. They talked about that old roof as if things were just the same as they had always been. Talked about it as if they would be spending next summer under the new cedar shingles, just as they had spent the last 9 summers under the old cedar shingles. Mort thought, give me a roof, give me some shingles, and I'll talk to this bitch forever. As he listened to himself holding up his side of the conversation, he felt a deepening sense of unreality settling in. It felt as if he were returning to the half-waking, half-sleeping zombie state in which he had answered the phone. And at last he couldn't stand it anymore. If this was some sort of contest to see who would go the longest pretending that the last 6 months had never happened, then he was willing to concede. More than willing. She was asking where Greg was going to get the cedar shakes and if he would be using a crew from town when Mort broke in. Why did you call, Amy? There was a moment's silence in which he sensed her trying on responses and then rejecting them, like a woman trying on hats. And that did cause the anger to stir again. It was one of the things, one of the few things, actually, that he could honestly say he detested in her, that totally unconscious duplicity. I told you why, she said at last, to see if you were all right. She sounded flustered and unsure of herself again, and that usually meant she was telling the truth. When Amy lied, she always sounded as if she was telling you the world was round. I had one of my feelings. I know you don't believe in them, but I think you do know that I get them and that I believe in them. Don't you, Mort? There was none of her usual posturing or defensive anger. That was the thing. She sounded almost as if she were pleading with him. Yeah, I know that. Well, I had one. I was making myself a sandwich for lunch, and I had a feeling that you might not be all right. I held off for a while. I thought it would go away, but it didn't. So I finally called. You are all right, aren't you? Yes, he said. And nothing's happened? Well, something did happen, he said after only a moment of interior debate. He thought it was possible, maybe even likely, that John Shooter, if that's really his name, his mind insisted on adding, had tried to make contact with him in Derry before coming down here. Derry, after all, was where he usually was at this time of year. Amy might even have sent him down here. I knew it, she said. Did you hurt yourself with that goddamn chainsaw, or nothing requiring hospitalization, he said, smiling a little. Just an annoyance. Does the name John Shooter ring a bell with you, Amy? No, why? He let an irritated little sigh escape through his closed teeth like steam. Amy was a bright woman. But she had always had a bit of a dead short between her brain and her mouth. He remembered once musing that she should have a T-shirt reading, Speak Now, Think Later. Don't say no right off the bat. Take a few seconds and really think about it. The guy is fairly tall, about 6 feet, and I guess he's in his mid-40s. His face looked older, but he moved like a man in his 40s. He has a country kind of face, lots of colors, lots of sun wrinkles. When I saw him, I thought he looked like a character out of Faulkner. What's this all about, Mort? And now he felt all the way back. Now he could understand again why, as hurt and confused as he had been, he had rejected the urges he felt, mostly at night, to ask her if they couldn't at least try to reconcile their differences. He supposed he knew that if he asked long enough and hard enough, she would agree. But facts were facts. There had been a lot more wrong with their marriage than Amy's real estate salesman. The drilling quality her voice had taken on now, that was another symptom of what had killed them. "What have you done now?" the tone under the words asked, no, demanded. "What kind of a mess have you gotten yourself into now? Explain yourself." He closed his eyes and hissed breath through his clenched teeth again before answering. Then he told her about John Shooter and Shooter's manuscript and his own short story. Amy clearly remembered sowing season, but said she had never heard of a man named John Shooter. It wasn't the kind of name you forget, she said, and Mort was inclined to agree, in her life. And she certainly hadn't seen him. "You're sure?" Mort pressed. "Yes, I am," Amy said. She sounded faintly resentful of Mort's continued questioning. "I haven't seen anyone like that since you left, and before you tell me again not to say no right off the bat, let me assure you that I have a very clear memory of almost everything that's happened since then." She paused, and he realized she was speaking with an effort now, quite possibly with real pain. That small, mean part of him rejoiced. Most of him did not. Most of him was disgusted to find even a small part of him happy about any of this. That had no effect on the interior celebrant, however. That guy might be outvoted, but he also seemed impervious to Mort's, the larger Mort's, attempts to root him out. "Maybe Ted saw him," he said. Ted Milner was the real estate agent. He still found it hard to believe she had tossed him over for a real estate agent, and he supposed that was part of the problem, part of the conceit which had allowed things to progress to this point in the first place. He certainly wasn't going to claim, especially to himself, that he had been as innocent as Mary's little lamb, was he? "Is that supposed to be funny?" Amy sounded angry, ashamed, sorrowful, and defiant all at the same time. "No," he said. He was beginning to feel tired again. "Ted isn't here," she said. "Ted hardly ever comes here. I go to his place." "Oh, thank you for sharing that with me, Amy," he almost said, and choked it off. It would be nice to get out of at least one conversation without a swap of accusations. So he didn't say thanks for sharing, and he didn't say that'll change, and most of all he didn't ask, "What in the hell's the matter with you, Amy?" Mostly because she might then have asked the same thing of him. She had suggested he call Dave Newsom, the Tashmore constable. After all, the man might be dangerous. Mort told her he didn't think that would be necessary, at least not yet, but if John Shooter called by again, he would probably give Dave a jingle. After a few more stilted amenities, they hung up. He could tell she was still smarting over his oblique suggestion that Ted might currently be sitting in Morty Bear's chair and sleeping in Morty Bear's bed. But he honestly didn't know how he could have avoided mentioning Ted Milner sooner or later. The man had become a part of Amy's life after all. And she had called him. That was the thing. She had gotten one of her funny feelings and called him. Mort reached the place where the lakeside path forked, the right-hand branch climbing the steep bank back up to Lake Drive. He took that branch, walking slowly and savoring the fall color. As he came around the final curve in the path and into sight of the narrow ribbon of blacktop, he was somehow not surprised to see the dusty blue station wagon with the Mississippi plates parked there like an oft-whipped dog chained to a tree, nor the lean figure of John Shooter propped against the right front mudguard with his arms folded across his chest. Mort waited for his heartbeat to speed up, for the surge of adrenaline into his body. But his heart went on maintaining its normal beat, and his glands kept their own counsel, which for the time being seemed to be to remain quiet. The sun, which had gone behind a cloud, came out again, and fall colors, which had already been bright, now seemed to burst into flame. His own shadow reappeared, dark and long and clear-cut. Shooter's round black hat looked blacker, his blue shirt bluer, and the air was so clear the man seemed scissored from a swatch of reality that was brighter and more vital than the one Mort knew as a rule. and he understood that he had been wrong about his reasons for not calling Dave Newsom. Wrong, or practicing a little deception, on himself as well as on Amy. The truth was that he wanted to deal with this matter himself. Maybe just to prove to myself that there are things I still can deal with, he thought, and started up the hill again, toward where John Shooter was leaning against his car and waiting for him.